Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. I'm sure everybody out there, even if you have no interest in Zen, has a certain association or set of associations with Zen practice, with the word Zen. And one of the reasons I'm so sure about this is because of the ubiquity of the phrase Zen and the art of. Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance being a classic hippie philosophy book from back in the day, which we'll be talking about later in the show. But the phrase has migrated and propagated quite widely. In fact, one of the appendices of R. John Williams' new book, The Buddha in the Machine, Art, Technology, and the Meeting of East and West, which we'll be talking about today. One of these appendices is called Zen and the Art of in Contemporary Discourse, and it's basically a kind of poem of the extraordinary number of books and websites that use this phrase in terms of Zen and the Art of Computing, Zen and the Art of Medicaid, Zen and the Art of the SAT, Zen and the Art of Backyard Barbecue, on and on and on, for pages, literally pages of this, which raises an interesting question. Why? How did Zen and the art of doing something become associated? And R. John Williams, in his book, digs down into this question super deep and super wide. It's really one of the more reframing books I've read in a while, by which I mean it took a bunch of themes and ideas in history and spirituality and American culture, technology, and reframed them in a way that really changed my sense of what's going on. And what he's particularly tracking is what he calls Asia as techne, the idea that Asian culture, particularly East Asian culture and art, offers the benighted West an alternative model of how to deal with the technological culture that we've created, especially since the late 19th century. So rather than the usual dialectic of the developed West and the purely mystic East, instead there's a much more interesting transformative sort of feedback loop of projection, mostly from the Western side, though not entirely, of Asia as a site of a more organic, a more balanced, a more artful, a more natural kind of technology, which can come in turn and transform, remake, and rebalance a Western technology culture that is more heady, mechanical, driven, violent, out of whack, etc., etc. I suspect many of you are starting to have bells ringing in your head, but what's great about John's book is he goes all over the place. Each chapter is almost like a whole other world. There's a chapter on Charlie Chan movies. There's a chapter on Jack London going to sailing through the Pacific and how he responded to surfing culture. There's a wonderful chapter with beautiful illustrations of how Japanese design became embraced by book manufacturers and architects, especially Frank Lloyd Wright, in the late 19th century, again, as a way to sort of tame what was already seen as the ravages of Western technology, of the machine age. So it's a wonderful book of both of distant connections and resonances, and there's lots of marvelous crosstalk between images and words that really sketch a very complicated resonating field of ideas and images. And at the same time, particularly in the latter chapters where he addresses our current technological culture more directly. The book is really a striking sort of intervention in this ongoing, in fact, in some ways even increasing, or at least returning with a strong power, imbrication of quote-unquote Asian or Eastern culture and Western culture, including that very idea of East and West, which really structures how we think about culture, consciousness, politics, but is like, well, almost everything, if not everything, also a historical story. So I really look forward to talking to John about this wonderful and quite beautiful book as well. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja, so if you were going to write a book that was Zen and the Art of, what would you make it? Was Zen and the Art of what?
I would make it Zen and the Art of Making Zen into Any Art That You Do. No, it's true. I love that idea. It's like Kung Fu, you know? Like a lot of movies try to get forward that idea in the Kung Fu movies where it's like, Kung Fu is in everything. Like, I don't know if you saw that movie, The God of Cookery. You know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah,
it was by the guy that did Shell and Soccer, same filmmaker. But he basically, it's like that idea that everything you do has Kung Fu in it, right? Like from cooking food to the way you walk down the street to how you're going to talk to your friends, right? So that idea of including Zen in a state of being in the actions of what you do, that's the technique, that's the art. The machine is the ability to make the work that you're doing, like, awesome, right?
Well, and then that's one of the really stark and important parts of John's book, and then we'll bring him on and actually talk to him, but is you talk about the work that you're doing, but then, of course, we do all sorts of work. You know, a lot of people work in advertising, or they work for corporations that are extracting minerals from benighted countries in order to make little gadgets and sell them. Yep. People are working for the NSA. There's all sorts of work out there. And so the capacity of Zen to fit into a work world, and particularly the technology world, particularly advanced capitalism, goes all too well, as we'll see. Yeah. I mean, it's really extraordinary how deep some of these ideas have come into contemporary capitalism.
Yeah, it's universal is what it is.
Yeah, so with that, let's bring our John Williams on to the show. Hey, John, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, as I said, I mean, it's one of the great delights of the book is its sprawling nature. Clearly, you went in lots of different directions and dug deep and found different versions, sometimes quite different, of this basic pattern of West finding something in the East and recirculating it in a variety of complicated ways. What got you going on this? I mean, you teach English, so you've got a literature background. What was the sort of first thread that tugged you in this very interesting and not exactly literary direction?
Well, it began probably about 10 years ago. I was teaching English in China, and I was living in a city called Guangzhou, which is over 20 million people, and I began noticing that there were, you know, farmers out working in rice fields who had cell phones. There were massive transformations happening to the kind of urban landscape that seemed to be kind of leapfrogging over some of the more kind of banal, normal developments of industrial life into this kind of advanced technological space. And at that same time, I was reading a lot of novels by the Chinese-American novelist Lin Yutong, who in the book I write about as beginning to attempt the invention of the Chinese typewriter. And that notion of the Chinese typewriter, which seems so counterintuitive and oxymoronic almost, because you have these thousands of Chinese ideographs, and yet this attempt to kind of structure them within this very kind of rigid machine, struck me as a really fascinating idea, a possibility. And then when I began looking at all of the things that Lin was describing about the ideological and political potential of his Chinese typewriter, I began to see that he was referencing all of these other discourses going on both in China and in the West regarding what role technology was playing in modern life and how the East could somehow serve as a kind of antidote to it. And all of that kind of went into the Chinese typewriter chapter, but then like a kind of hub with spokes out of it, I began to notice all of these other realms where that same kind of mythology was beginning to spread. And eventually, over, you know, several years of kind of looking into all of the different places this was happening, a kind of chronological arc began to emerge with something like the late 19th century American fascination with Japan and its aesthetics and religion, on through, you know, Steve Jobs, who goes out to India and talks to gurus and then comes back and designs, you know, computational products that are supposedly endowed with all of this kind of Zen quality. So it's kind of a long answer, I guess, but the basic idea began with that sense of trying to figure out what a Chinese typewriter was doing in the middle of the 20th century.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I really want to get to that computer age stuff, because I think that it's something that people are simultaneously very aware of. Even people who aren't that interested in spirituality and meditation can recognize that there's a lot of the sort of ideas of some concept of Zen or going with the flow or Tao or something that's operating inside, paradoxically, this hyper-technological culture. And you have very good ways of saying how that's developed with management, et cetera. So it's a juicy tale. But before we get there, I would like to spend a little bit more time with a slightly earlier era, just to kind of set up, particularly in the late 19th century, early 20th century, what were some of the main features and even individuals who are helping to kind of create this concept of Asia as an alternative zone of craft and art and even technology. And, you know, I'm thinking particularly you might introduce us to Fenollosa, who was a character, a name that I'd heard about. You know, a little bit, footnote here, something, and I never really knew very much about him. A fascinating story. It seems to really capture a lot of what that shift is about at that time.
Right. Well, Fenollosa, Ernest Fenollosa, kind of a New England transcendentalist, is most often referred to as the person who wrote the essay that the more famous poet Ezra Pound edited and circulated, called the Chinese Character as a Medium for Poetry. And the idea of that, as kind of edited and circulated and promoted by Ezra Pound, was that the kind of interesting architect of the Chinese character, that is, the kind of ideograph where you have, you know, juxtaposed pictographic elements that exist side by side without connecting links, that this could serve as a model for a new kind of re-energized American, Anglo-American poetry. What I discovered about Ezra Pound's fascination with Fenollosa was that much of it was grounded in certain assumptions about Oriental, quote-unquote, you know, Asian aesthetics. And I found that Fenollosa actually had a much longer history going back to the time when he was invited to go teach in Japan. And when he got to Japan, he noticed that the Meiji Restoration was in sort of full swing, which was this moment when Japan was trying to rapidly modernized. They were sending their young students out to the West to learn new forms of industrialization, technology, management, and so on, and coming back and radically changing the Japanese cultural landscape. And there was a lot of anxiety from within Japan about what that was doing to traditional Japanese culture. And Fenollosa became convinced that something of Japan's traditional techne, right, their kind of way of existing organically, more ecologically with the environment, something of that was being lost. And so he sort of joined the campaign to help preserve much of that in Japan, almost aligning himself with various forms of Japanese nationalism that were resisting westernization. And in the 1890s, he brought that back to Boston and helped really transform the whole vision of what Asia could do for the West in New England. And he was specifically invited to curate much of the Japanese exhibits at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. It's this sort of famous, huge event where millions of people came from all over the world to see exhibits from different countries. And the West, of course, was there with all of their machines and their technology and their massive architectural neoclassical facades and so on. And Fenollosa helped curate this very kind of organic, beautiful pavilion that the Japanese had, and they put all of these gorgeous screens and ceramics and paintings and things in. And that image of Japan kind of offering this beautiful, highly civilized, right, not the kind of barbaric yellow peril hordes of Asia or whatever, but a very highly civilized alterity to what the West was offering began to really catch on after that fair. And as I describe in that second chapter, it became part of book design, it became part of the whole poster art movement, and it really kind of set up the stage for much of what's going to follow throughout the 20th century, where Asia is no longer necessarily thought of as this barbaric other, but as this highly civilized and kind of potentially valuable way through the kind of bizarre labyrinth of Western modernity.
One interesting thing that popped out about him is that he was also interested in the spiritual life. Like he was a convert, if I remember correctly, to Tendai Buddhism, which is a kind of itself a sort of nouveau strain of Japanese Buddhism with a strong esoteric dimension. How much like was his the role he played in constructing and transmitting this idea of Asia as a kind of alternate organic techne, how much was that came out of kind of his own personal spiritual view of the world?
Oh, it was absolutely central. It was one of the things that really transformed him as a person. I mean, when he went there to Japan, he was teaching Hegel, he was teaching Emerson, I mean, he was teaching all of the sort of classics of Western canonical literary life. And when he got to Asia, part of that fascination with the art was this new philosophical religious identity that he began to craft for himself. One of his famous students was a man named Okakura Kakuzo, who later on went on to write the very famous Book of Tea that you see, you know, in the bargain rack at Barnes & Noble now and so on. But both of them were very active in Tendai Buddhism. Fenollosa wrote quite a bit about the philosophy of Buddhism and what it had to offer the spiritual life. And so that, I think that's a very big part of the equation, something that actually his editor, Ezra Pound, later on will sort of leave off, because Pound was less fascinated with Buddhism and sort of organic life than he was the kind of machine culture that he picks up from Fenollosa. But it's absolutely central, and I think in ways it's even this kind of surrogate underground philosophy that continues on into our present day, and not a lot of people know that Fenollosa had a really big part to play in shaping that notion that eventually, like as you said in your introduction, we'll call Zen and the Art Of, wherein Zen can literally become a part of a kind of more organic vision of what Western life can be in its totality.
One question I want to ask you just before we go on, because it's a really important, though sometimes kind of nebulous idea, and I'd love to give you the chance to define it better than I could, which is when you use this sort of phrase, Asia as techne, or we talk about techne or the Japanese techne as represented in the Chicago World's Fair.
Right.
What do we mean by that? How to think about that term? Because it's really important to recognize that the term technology, as we use it, is based, you know, has its own currents moving through it, and that the idea of techne is a really important concept or word to grasp as a way of broadening and opening up what we mean by technology.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So the word technology descends from the Greek techne. And one of the things I began noticing about many of these authors and artists that I was looking at is that whenever they wanted to remind their viewers or their readers that technology was originally something more artistic, they would bring up this Greek definition, because techne in the original Greek meant both art and technology, forms of craft, right? So in a way, whenever this word began to emerge, it was usually thought of as something you could bring out to remind people that technology needn't be this overly mechanized, highly oppressive industrial system, but that it could be something more personal, something more part of our human tool-making being, right? So this, and this happens throughout the late 19th and 20th century. I mean, even today there's a very famous Korean sculptor who created the cover for my book, or, you know, a photograph of one of his sculptures. And even his blog says, you know, part of what I'm trying to convey is this sense of techne, that technology needn't be simply mechanical, but that it could be artful as well.
Well, let's describe, just because you brought him up, what his work looks like, because it does really capture some of the vibe, if you will, that you're trying to talk about in your book, particularly in a contemporary moment.
Right. These are some works of art that really blew my mind. His name is Wang Ziwon, so WangZiwon. And if you Google his work, you'll see that there are all of these Buddhas that have been retro or kind of integrally fitted with machines. So you have one that's like a bodhisattva with many, many different arms, and they're all attached to these gears and levers. And there are a couple of videos online where you can actually see them sort of slowly moving with this kind of almost creepy dynamic form. And when I saw them, I thought, oh my God, this is like the perfect embodiment of what I'm describing here, because these Buddhas, as, you know, modeled in these sculptures, have these very pensive Zen-like faces, but they're completely mechanical. They're these machines that have been sort of set up to move in certain ways or to just sort of sit there meditatively. And that conflation of the machine and the Buddha, it was in many ways the perfect thing. I mean, he was very generous in allowing me to use the art for the book, and it's really the perfect illustration of what I'm describing.
It reminds me also of that. I think, you know, maybe 20 years ago, the cover of your book would have been that famous Nanjun Paik work where the Buddha is sitting there looking at the video monitor of a camera that's looking at him. So you get this sort of idea of feedback and the emptiness of the image, but it's such a remarkable, you know, there's something about these points in artistic practice where the Buddha figure can be turned in a certain way, and in some ways there's nothing really quite like the Buddha as a figure for this whole larger idea of the Asia as techne, you know, and you bring the Buddha into the title of your book, and then there's that Japanese book you mentioned, the Buddha and the Robot, which is
right.
Something I scarfed up way back in the day when I found it. And so it's interesting to think about, what is it about this religious figure, this God man, the founder of religious practice, et cetera, that somehow fits, because it seems like that
right.
fit is resonating. The reason it is because it's calling up these almost unconscious associations. Is it because the Buddha has no idea of a self somehow? Somehow the idea of Buddhism as a kind of process of deconstructing essences and entities into these fields of interconnection somehow lends itself, you know, to technology?
Right.
Is it because we need some kind of archetype of this idea of Asia as techne? What's going on with that Buddha, that technological Buddha?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that it has become the sort of overarching ethos of our technological culture. Like, if you were to go to Silicon Valley today, and let's say you're pitching an idea and you were to walk into many of the offices there, it would not at all be uncommon for you to see a Buddha on a bookshelf, or something from the Tao, a painting on the wall or something. But it would seem really strange and different if you were to walk in and see something like a crucifix and a verse from the Bible or something. I think investors would probably run far away from that person's office. And that sense of the kind of correlative, natural adaptation of Buddhism for our technological culture is definitely the kind of overarching experience that many of us are having. The question is, why exactly does it do that? And I mean, one answer might be that Buddhism is kind of inherently capacious. You can literally be a Buddhist and also anything else, right? And that's part of the reductive sort of powerful logic of Zen and the art of. But I think a more complicated, interesting answer might be that Buddhism does kind of speak to the inherently integrated, networked reality that is the cosmos, right? The idea is in Buddhism that we're all in some ways in flux. We're organisms that have kind of temporarily organized themselves here on this planet, but that everything is kind of in flux. The planet itself is kind of moving through space, and that the more our machines became like that integrated, networked sort of experience, the more it seemed appropriate for us to have some kind of metaphorical religiosity that reflected that, I think.
Well, here the leap I make is to that wonderful video, which is on your website, so it's totally worth tracking down, of Alan Watts presenting this model of the grid and the curvy line, and you know that leads into cybernetics and stuff. But let's just talk about that Watts moment, because he really read cybernetics. He had some sense of what it meant. He was trying to articulate Zen art and Zen philosophy in accessible terms. It was very, very extraordinarily influential. He lives large. He's in her. He's still on the airways. So talk about Watts and how he really helped, in some ways, begin a certain idea that continues to totally inform our experience of technology.
Well, I should also direct your listeners to your own book, Technosis, which was, in many ways, what helped get me started down this path of the cybernetic Zen and the idea that Buddhism could somehow be conflated and integrated with technology. Alan Watts is, in many ways, one of these sort of catalysts for imagining a different kind of technological experience by way of a countercultural ethos where we're not thinking anymore in terms of simple top-down corporate management and Western Christianity, but we're thinking through things that are more hip, more, as he says, wiggly, right? He loved the word wiggly. He says, nature, it's very, very wiggly. You go out into nature, you look at the trees, you look at the rivers and so on, and everything is very wiggly. And what we tend to do, and what he illustrates in that video, is we tend to impose this kind of grid-like matrix over it. And suppose that there is this kind of squared, geometrical way of dominating nature. And he says, that's good, that's fine. However, if we begin to forget that nature is, in fact, underneath that, quite wiggly and organic, then all of a sudden we sort of lose something of that. So for him, I think he saw cybernetics in that moment of, the whole cybernetic revolution that happens at the Macy, the New York Macy conferences, where a whole bunch of intellectuals, scientists, philosophers, and so on all get together and start to describe what this new science of cybernetics is going to be. He saw that and didn't see that as discontinuous with Buddhism, but as rather kind of something he could integrate into this whole countercultural worldview he was trying to promote.
And again, we're still living in that. I mean, those ideas became steadily more pervasive. I mean, there's an article in the San Francisco or Haight Street hippie rag, the Oracle, that talks about cybernetics as part of this emerging world, and it helps inform the Whole Earth Catalog, and so it really moves into the kind of idea space that surrounds early computing and networking as a kind of cultural idea. Let's kind of go into that, because it's tricky, because on the one hand, it makes a lot of sense philosophically in terms of the relationship of technology and nature, that nature is still part of our existence, that there's these systems and networks, and there's a kind of more or less appropriate way of responding to that, and yet it's also so ideological, and we can see so many difficulties that come out of that as well. You know, as a historian, how do you kind of try to approach that really complex network of forces and ideas?
Well, I feel like part of what I'm describing also has to be a little bit of a critique, because as you say, this notion of Zen and the art of, or Taoism being the kind of ethos of global capitalism, needs to be taken into consideration, right? Like, I think there are ways in which this particular form of organizing our philosophical beings has lended itself in kind of frightful ways sometimes to forms of predatory capitalism that can go unchecked, right? That where we kind of tend to embrace the networked transnational possibilities of all of these corporations, the multinationals, the ways in which regulation would seem to somehow impede the Zen flow of economic goods and so on. So in a way, I think that it's a compelling fantasy, this idea that, you know, Zen could offer us somehow an antidote. But on the other hand, I think we need to be very careful that, I mean, it's not just that we're in some ways transforming Buddhism into this kind of weirdly capitalist technological framework, but I think there's also something dangerous about what we're doing with our own culture, right? And I think of that in terms of a global culture, right? I think that there are ways in which, even in Japan, this became, this notion that Zen could be adapted to technology and robot life and so on, became a way of kind of justifying many of the corporate hierarchies, many of the kind of mechanistic cultures that they've also struggled to deal with as well. So I think it's a global problem, but also a kind of global mythology. It's something that we have all kind of subconsciously, even those of us who are not, you know, Buddhists. I'm not a practicing Buddhist myself or anything, but I do see the sort of compelling logic of allowing our aesthetic life, our philosophical beings, to sort of be led along by this form of understanding our technological life. But on the other hand, it's also, as I said, quite dangerous as well, that we forget what some of the more compelling narratives of equality and actually regulated forms of a political being that I think could be brought back in some important ways as well.
Absolutely. No, these are crucial critiques right now. But we're going to take a break.
Okay.
Right now you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Arjan Williams about the Buddha and the machine, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're talking with Erica Davis and John Williams about Zen, Buddha, Techni, Asia, and all those dum-dums over here in the West that are still trying to catch up. So before the break, you talked about something that was really important, which is the danger involved. And I mean, for me, I think it's, you could similarly compare people's response to these technologies they've made, whether it's a computer or a corporation or a statue, right? So you can have people will give all the power over to a Buddha statue, just like here we'll give it all over to a system or a corporation or a political figure. And that transference that happens, like what Eric was talking about with the Buddha staring at the screen, I think, like, it prevents people from experiencing a certain level of the reality of it. So I wonder, what do you think about the, like, consciousness of the technology versus the consciousness of ourselves or whatever's making that technology? Kind of like the difference between us trying to dominate nature, right? Is that technology that we're making that is included in the Buddha mind, that is part of all the consciousness of everything? Is there like a ghost in that machine that is its own thing, its artificial intelligence? Or do you think it's more like a reflection situation?
Well, that's a difficult question about where we're headed, I actually think. It's a good question. And I should probably say that I'm not in any way kind of advocating some sort of Western Christianity as an antidote to the Zen and the art of Buddhist philosophies that we're describing, partly because I think Christianity has similarly adapted itself in frightful ways to global capitalism and forms of exploitation as well. So I'm certainly not suggesting that, you know, one adopt a Western or Eastern religious philosophy as a result. But I do think that something of the Zen and the art of in our technological consciousness is something we need to think twice about. Something of the way that, you know, that Zen presents itself as this clean, spare, and very kind of meditative way of experiencing technological life has a way of shielding us from some of the more dirty industrial qualities of things that are actually going on around the world. So when you get your new iPhone, you know, it's kind of portrayed in advertisements as this thing that just could have grown right out of the grass. It's just like this glorious object, like a forbidden fruit from a tree, where you pick it and you touch your finger and it recognizes immediately the organic shape of your fingerprint. And there's this way in which it becomes this kind of almost biological companion for us, and it has this way of connecting us to other people and to other parts of the world, and so we sort of have this feeling that it's this completely organic object, when in fact, as Eric alluded to earlier in the show, there's also a very dark industrial fact that there are people laboring often under age and without breaks and in exploited conditions that are actually creating the kind of Zen-like clean experience of technological being and consciousness that we have. So I think in some ways that idea of the Buddha and technology has a way of shielding us because of the cleanliness of it, because of the spare meditative quality that makes us feel like our technological life is somehow divorced from the banalities and the evils of industrialism. And that's
happens
what, in that...
How you could, I mean, you could look at the pyramids, right, and get that clean Zen feeling, but then, like, how many slaves died while they made the pyramids, right?
Right, right. Yeah, so there's something of that, only our pyramids are extremely small and we hold them in our hands and
exactly.
We connect with other people through them. Well, yeah.
And it's really important to emphasize, I mean, the when we think about Apple and we think about Steve Jobs and the enormous cultural mythology that's grown up around these products and you know, his influences going to India, LSD, fruit diet, the whole kind of West Coast, Bay Area world, just how much, not just the kind of... concepts, but just the design itself of Apple products and that minimalism, that sense of kind of cleanliness, of clarity, of space, it really does derive from Jobs' own kind of sense of a certain kind of, you know, Eastern response to, you know, boring Windows, linear, IBM-ish kind of technology,
right.
And it's just every this Asia as techné that you're describing is not some abstract concept that only affects people who are, you know, trying to think spiritually or philosophically about these things. It's embodied and carried forward in these in so many of these products, and it's really, you know, it's quite extraordinary when you think about it that way. But another side of it, which is I think your book does a particularly wonderful and important job of showing how these ideas around flow, around networks, around kind of open unpredictability, spontaneity, really go into capitalism in a very concrete way through marketing and management ideas in particular. And you trace how some of the emerging management figures who give companies ideas about how to organize themselves internally and externally, how to move through the spaces of possibility of development and marketing and global presence, and how some of this core kind of
software, if you will, of how to organize, how to manage, was really directly influenced by some of these ideas we're talking about. So I'd love to have you give us a little snapshot of that very, very influential development.
That's right. So some of the earliest management theories had nothing to do with Zen. It was a man named Frederick Winslow Taylor who went in the early 20th century with a stopwatch to different factories and would sort of time with his stopwatch how much time it took someone to move a shovel of dirt from point A to point B, and it became a very kind of scientific, mechanistic way of doing business. But in the 1950s, with Japan's reconstruction, there was a whole series of different experimental modes of managing workers, of organizing the corporate culture, and so on, that tried to tap into what we now identify as a kind of countercultural ethos, where hierarchy was less emphasized, where kind of management organization was replaced with team building, and many of the kind of feel-good exercises that we associate with the kind of googlier workspaces of today. And I think this dynamic between Japan attempting to reorganize itself according to new modes of management and the West having a number of panics, especially the 1973 oil crisis, which kind of set off this anxiety that we were becoming that our machines were too big, that we needed to become more efficient. And in the 1980s, when Japan becomes this huge economic force, teams of management scholars would head off to Japan and try to learn what it was that they were doing so efficiently and so valuably. And it was there that they encountered many of these kind of Zen forms, that there were Zen Buddhists who would become part of organizations, part of the corporations that were there making cars and TVs and radios and all of the things that the West was trying to catch up with. And that book that we mentioned earlier in the program, The Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, actually had a curiously interesting role to play in all of that. It was one of the really surprising things that I discovered as I was trying to sort of track the reader's responses to that book, because it so perfectly embodies this Asia as techne philosophy that I was researching. I began to see that it was appearing in all of these different management studies, that people who were trying to talk about total quality management and new forms of corporate culturalism were referring to this book about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance as a really good description of the kind of integrated, networked quality management that corporations needed to adopt for the future. So it really played into what in the 1990s becomes this austere form of corporate management, where people are being laid off and corporations are becoming more streamlined and able to adapt at a moment's notice to sort of just-in-time production and things that were all part of what in Japan is kind of called the larger philosophy of Toyotism, because Toyota was one of the companies that really spearheaded many of these reforms. So it really does, in a way, become not just a part of the kind of aesthetic ethos of Steve Jobs and the design of the iPod, even though it's definitely part of that. It's also part of this kind of nittier, grittier sort of management organization that's going on behind the scenes that a lot of people wouldn't have necessarily have been aware of, even though it restructures many of the companies that are still around today.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty big thing right there, just in terms of how people see Asia, right? I mean, that whole Chinese mentality is less surrounded on, like, individuals' happiness. Like, here in the West, everyone is super narcissistic and wants to be happy and get what they want. But a lot of the mentality in Asia is more like, well, how about the fact that there's, like, billions of people in China and we got to figure out just what to do? So it becomes more, less emotional and more kind of like nature. Like, well, if you mess up, you're just going to get eaten by the lion and then we're just going to keep going forward, right? It has that, for some people, it seems a little bit harsh, that Toyotism, but I mean, do you feel like that's more of just them being practical and natural instead of being so accommodating to, like, people that want stuff?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the part of what part of what might be explaining some of that is the flexibility of Zen, because there are in fact ways of experiencing Zen that are very strict, very hierarchical. Where if you're a new Zen devotee, it can be an extremely regimented kind of experience, and some
right.
of that almost sort of feudal management style structure became part of what was compelling to Westerners who were visiting Japan in the 1970s and 80s. But then there's also this side of Zen that is very, very kind of feel-good, you know, kind of LSD-style, integrated, it's all connected sort of ethos that you see people talking about in Silicon Valley. So I think part of it could be explained by that flexibility, that Zen can kind of work in both ways as a model for the kinds of corporations that you want to be able to organize. So I think that what happened was management experts in the 1980s saw this and said, these are insights that can help us transform and already have a kind of metaphorical resonance that we can adopt and run with throughout, you know, the future. And it's still very much with us today.
Well, that brings us to this critique, and we've talked about it in different ways on the show a number of times, the sort of best represented by Zizek, or at least most famously, where he takes it in even another direction, which is rather than looking at the structure of corporations, management philosophy, technological design philosophy, the ideology of new technologies, but just in terms of what people are doing now in the West to try to keep themselves sane to a degree, or accommodating or adapted to this incredibly bizarre, challenging, frightening world that we're involved with, even just in terms of jobs, just in terms of, you know, surviving the 24/7 cycle of work and news and the complexity of life, the vertiginous quality of constantly evolving technologies, which is that many people are turning more and more to some form of meditation, some form of mindfulness practice, a kind of yoga as a way of sort of easing the body. And what Zizek's argument is that this is the perfect, as you've mentioned, the perfect ideology for capitalism, and not just ideology, not just terms of an idea, but even practices, because they enable people to sort of suspend their reactivity, suspend their terror, and to just kind of adapt, to learn how to sort of let go and to open up space and to not be as reactive. And in a way, it's a very healthy response, and clearly millions of people are benefiting in their personal lives, and probably their families work better and they're happier, and, you know, things that are hard to argue against. And yet there's a creepy sense that Zizek points out, that there's, that in a way all this is doing is just kind of, you know, enabling people to get along better with an atrocious situation. And it's a very complicated idea of whether or not these, because these ideas are so embedded in contemporary capitalism, are they like hopelessly stained as vehicles of self-development, of clarity, of compassion for others? Is the idea that these tools and techniques can be helpful for people today inherently kind of, I'll use the word stained again, because of this intense ideological underpinning of these Asian ideas?
No, that's a really great way of framing the problem. Because, I mean, in some ways, this, we have to be sensitive to, you know, I understand when, you know, you get the yoga mat out and the app that helps one meditate, and there are all these ways of really just sort of coping with the frenetic pace of modern life. And that's a totally appropriate response, I think, that these more meditative forms of being have to become part of our everyday coping mechanisms. But on the other hand, it can also lead to this obfuscation of political consciousness, where instead of realizing that there are aspects of our political structures that need radical change and that need us to kind of agitate and not be so meditative and zen about things, but to actually demand in collective form some of the changes that we need.
Well, that is, I think a lot of people misinterpret many aspects of Zen, because, I mean, if we're just discussing it, like, in terms of Japan and some of those techniques, I mean, who were some of the most famous practitioners of Zen were samurai, who were not afraid at all to fight or stand up for things or go against things. Like, the idea of Zen is this peaceful thing. I mean, Zen warriors are a real thing on the earth, and the guy who founded Zen taught all the Shaolin monks how to do kung fu. So there is an aspect of fighting involved in Zen, but it's like fighting peacefully to uphold and protect what is, you know, what your will is, kind of.
That's right. And I hasten to add that there are very politically engaged forms of Zen Buddhism, both in the West and in Japan and China, that where people are actively working to, you know, curb greenhouse gases and are thinking of Buddhism not as a kind of way of meditating through some sort of coping with political reality, but actually trying to change it. And I think that those are some of the, you know, most powerful forms of organizing that we have. I like to think of it, you know, the way that people talk about, you know, I have people that are really ecologically minded tend to think of their technological experience in terms of offsets. Like, I took, you know, I took a plane ride, and then I also paid to have a tree planted or something.
Right.
And what I would like to see is that for everyone who engages in meditative Zen and yoga and all of these forms of coping with the frenetic pace of industrial life, if there were also a way to say, well, I'm offsetting that with political agitation in all of these other forms of my life. I'm donating to this cause, or I'm, you know, marching in this protest, simply because I think that those are really, in many ways, the way that we change our culture. They're the ways that lead to reforms, and, you know, things like the weekend would have never happened without political organization.
Well, yeah,
so
I mean, Bodhidharma, the guy that started Zen, was a revolutionary. Like, he was an absolute revolutionary who changed politics in several countries. So it's really true.
Sure, yeah.
No, I think that's a really, really helpful point, because, and then this is like one of the problems that I have with Zizek, for example, is that if you see the way in which a certain set of ideas and or practices can be plugged into a problematic situation, so the way that Zen ideas and can become part of the ideological structure of late capitalism, that doesn't mean that they are inherently useless or damaged. Like, that there are opportunities to move, that there are creative potentials within different philosophies that can be developed and responded to, and that there's a tendency sometimes to over essentialize, oh, Buddhism and yoga, that's just for people who are just trying to, they're not really being political anymore, there's not really a political consciousness anymore. But it seems like they too have the possibilities, and in fact are already manifesting ways of more taking the situation we're in more critically, and really of feeling compelled to respond to the situation rather than just kind of turn within and learn how to buffer the self from the trauma.
There may even be more of an opportunity, because I think many of those people who are invested in Western Buddhism and yoga and so on also happen to be more liberally minded. They're less likely to side with, you know, Supreme Court rulings on Hobby Lobby and so on, where... You know, I really think that there is an opportunity here that we can, if we can kind of draw attention to the fact that there's this potential, as Zizek says, for these aesthetics to become simple coping mechanisms rather than political ideologies, there's an opportunity there to transform it. And I think that is the trap that Zizek falls into, is that he kind of essentializes Buddhism as inherently non-political, and so therefore he's led to kind of intimate, even though he's a Lacanian atheist and a Marxist, he kind of is led to intimate that Western Christianity must somehow be the answer, because it's more homogenous, it's more monolithic, it's more likely to, you know, as he thinks, kind of engender a political consciousness. But I don't think that that's the case. I think Christianity is similarly damaged in some ways and needs to be, and which isn't to say that Christians couldn't also participate in a greater political consciousness. They tend not to these days, unfortunately, in America, but I do think that there are these opportunities that we could take advantage of. I mean, the book I wrote is not a political tract, so I hate to kind of like present it as though it were that, but there is, in some ways, this critique floating through the book that tries to address specifically that question.
Well, you know, we just got a few minutes here. do you think there's still a kind of, I mean, whether or not it's going to happen anyway is beside the point, but a kind of utility? Is there still something useful about this fundamental divide we still carry even into our globalized world of East and West? Is there still some juice there, something productive, or is it at this point so wrapped up in all of these histories and ideologies that it sort of no longer really serves?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's hard to imagine a time when we won't think of the globe as being sort of culturally divided between East and West, even though I think it's definitely disappearing in cultural forms, right? There is a kind of homogenization of cultural life that's happening all over the world. And you can see that even in the disappearance of languages, right? Like, there's the fact that there used to be 7,000-plus languages spoken on the earth, and now there's much less than that. So there's a way in which we're becoming inherently more integrated, more networked, and less likely to think of ourselves in terms of East and West. But the cultural fantasies live on. There's still this sort of vision that the West is some kind of entity, and it has its own cultural parameters and protocols and ways of doing things, and the East has its own ways of doing things. So it's disappearing in curious ways, but it is still there.
We got just a minute or two left. I wanted to let people know they can check out your website, rjohnwilliamswordpress.com, and definitely check out The Buddha and the Machine, Art, Technology, and the Meeting of East and West. And I have to, you know, re-emphasize that it's a very beautiful book. There's lots and lots of images, and the images don't just illustrate but are also kind of active characters, if you will, as they resonate and get refracted back and forth between a wide variety of social and technological locations. So it's really quite a fun a bit there. And just one question to wrap it up, like, how much of the illustrations of the book, the idea of making a very beautifully illustrated book with lots of images, was in some sense necessary to your project of kind of showing and reminding people where these aesthetics that seem so almost transparent to us, where they really come from?
Well, that's a great question. The book is a kind of an academic book, so it tries to make an argument. And I've always been sort of visually inclined, and so it struck me as an opportunity to make a kind of visual argument for the kinds of cultural the sort of cultural wallpaper that exists all around us. So I did argue with the press about how many images could be put in, and if there's even fewer than I wanted, even though there are several hundred images. But it struck me as a great opportunity to sort of demonstrate, not just kind of describe, but actually perform some of the aesthetic that we're living with and where it came from. So I really appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it was real. It's a great success. So congratulations on that. And thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you.
All right. From Maj and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.